Okay, so this is how it went down. One thing I like to do around this time of year is just compose a list, a simple list of things I'm grateful for. So I sit down to write about how thankful I am for this beautiful ride-or-die woman who's on the journey with me. Thankful for these goofy kids we get to raise. For my health, for peaches, for heat, clothes. I'm thankful for the time I got to spend with my brother. I'm thankful for beautiful Oakland, California. Thankful for friends that I can call and ask for a kidney. Thankful for art, for sight, for work, for love, for family, for magic, for music, for story. I'm thankful for public schools. I'm thankful we might get a dog, and I'm putting all this on paper, and I start getting emotional, right? Because truthfully, before I started writing, my mind had wandered to a dark place, concentrating on things that weren't right, things that could go wrong, things that somebody said. And I look down at my paper, and I start to laugh because, honestly, I have more than I could ever wrap my arms around. And I'm so thankful that I got to write this list. So today, on Snap Judgment, it is the season. From PRX and NPR, we proudly present Gratitude. Amazing stories of Thanksgiving. My name is Glenn Washington. Let somebody know that you are happy to see them. Because this is Snap Judgment. So, we're going to start off today noting a very special type of courage. Snap Judgment's Anna Sussman spoke to Eileen O'Toole to learn her story of faith, of hope, and of gratitude. Snap Judgment.
I was very involved with my parish, and I went to Catholic school.
Now I'm Amy, down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep.
It was the mid-1940s in an Irish neighborhood of Brooklyn, and little Eileen O'Toole was an obedient Catholic schoolgirl.
And our whole neighborhood was very Catholic.
There were a few exceptions, like the family who owned the candy store down the block.
There was a Jewish family, two Jewish little boys, same age as I, whose parents owned a candy store. I would go there every day and buy a little bit of candy on the way back to school after lunch. And it was Stan and Isaac. Isaac wrote the most science books in the world, and Stan became the editor of Newsday.
So she would see Isaac Asimov, the future science fiction author, and his brother Stan, the future editor of Newsday. But in general, Catholics were her world. And there was a heavy weight on her young shoulders to devote her life to God. If she did become a nun, her parents and the whole neighborhood would be proud. And they would be set, not only in this life, but forever.
I really think that they thought that was their entrance into heaven, if they gave one of their children to God. I thought, why not give it a try? Maybe I would like it.
So Eileen gave it a try. She decided to become a nun. Her little Brooklyn neighborhood, her mom and dad, they rejoiced. And then the morning came for her to go to the convent. And for the first time, she began to think about herself.
And I walked out of my room, and I was trembling. Why am I doing this? How did I get myself into this situation? And all my relatives were there to say goodbye. And the priest who was helping me put me into the car right away. And the car took off, and I was on my way.
Walking into the convent, she comforted herself with the hope that it would only be for a short time, that she could leave when she wanted to.
When I first entered, I thought that I could just walk out. They held on to us, and they watched every move. We were out in the country, and there was no way that we could go anywhere. At night, I used to hear the Long Island Railroad horn blow, and I tell you, going to bed at night, I'd cry my eyes out. I just wanted to get on that train.
And then something in her snapped. And after prayers one afternoon, Eileen took off.
I said to myself, I'm out of here. And I didn't know that they could see me from the window where they were watching us. I remember holding up my skirt, running up that long, long road. And I nearly made it to the gate. But then the car came and got me and told me to come back.
Two nuns motioned for her to get in the car, and they drove her back up the hill. For 4 years, Eileen lived under the vigilant eyes of the superior nuns in the stony, regimented Mother House. And she was finally assigned to a church in New York City. This could be her chance to escape.
I was assigned to Bedford-Stuyvesant. It was really very, very poor and very tough.
Eileen was told that she would work directly under the Mother Superior, Sister Anna Germain. She was nervous.
So I went up the stairs, and there is this woman sitting in a leather lounge chair, which was totally forbidden. You had to sit on a straight chair all the time. And she had the nicest smile, and she welcomed me and said, "Welcome, dear. Now you make yourself at home." And I was just taken back, because usually they were just given orders to you. Go downstairs, do this, do that. She was so nice. So that was my first meeting with Sister Anna Germain.
And Sister Anna had her own philosophy. Do what you need to do to help the poor. Don't worry about the rules.
She said, "Now tomorrow I want you to go to this house, but you're not to tell anybody else that I'm sending you there. Make believe you're going for rolls to the local bakery and bring food to this house or bring money to this house." And I was her feet. And my main job was to walk the streets after teaching and help the poor.
It was technically against the rules for Eileen to leave the convent alone. But she was out there every day doing Sister Anna's work.
One of my first remembrances is that of a beautiful lady. I think she was a Spanish mother with about four children. She was on welfare, and she told me that the welfare person would come to the house, the man, and he said, "Unless you give me the favors of your body, I won't give you the welfare check." I just told Sister, I said, "I have to be there every Wednesday, so when he comes, he sees me standing right next to her. And then he'll give her the check." And that was one of the first things I did. That was definitely against the rule.
Breaking the rules became kind of a game. Like when Eileen noticed that the kids in her classroom didn't have the shoes they needed for their confirmation. She knew just where to find the funds she needed.
I said to the mothers, don't worry, I will buy them for you. I said, "I know where the money is from the Sunday collections, and I'm going to run in and grab money for these shoes." So I grabbed a bunch of money, and I said to the kids, "Follow me like Pied Piper down the avenue." We were all holding hands, and I went into the shoe store, and I said, "Outfit these children in with shoes and socks." And then I told Sister Anna what I did, and she laughed. She thought that was funny. But I had money left over, so she said, "Give them a party. You can't put the money back in the basket."
Under Sister Anna, Eileen didn't want to run.
What an eye-opening. I felt so good about the things that I was doing.
But Sister Anna was getting older. One day she fell ill, and she was taken to the hospital, and she never came back to the convent. Eileen was transferred to a wealthy parish in Long Island.
And everything was rules and regulations. I remember the superior telling me, "You enter the convent to take care of the nuns. You didn't enter the convent to take care of people or the poor." I was so upset. I didn't know what to do. And all I could think of was get out of the convent. And I went to Montauk. Montauk Point is the farthest end of Long Island. And you climb up and the cliffs and you see the ocean, the wild ocean. I had a veil on and, my habit. And I climbed up to the top of the cliffs and I said, "I am really not happy. I don't want to live like this anymore. I don't want this to be my life." And I looked out at the ocean. It was hitting against the point. And out on the horizon, it was calm. And I'll never forget the feeling. I went, "Oh my gosh, look how calm. God is telling me, that's okay. You'll be calm. You could do it. Everything will be all right. That's the moment I made up my mind.
She always thought she might not last in the convent, and now she was sure. She was going to break her vows.
You can't leave the convent unless you have a dispensation from your vows. And it's a serious, serious thing to break your vows against God. So what holy nun wants to break her vows against God? Well, then I had to go back and tell people, and that was tough.
It wasn't just her vow she was breaking. She was going to let down the whole family, most of all her mother. She went home for a family dinner to break the news and hoped they'd be understanding.
My sisters wouldn't tell her. They were afraid my mother would have a heart attack. I said, Mom, I'm really unhappy. And she just froze. She was standing at the sink. And I said, I want to leave the convent. She said, leave this house. I don't want to see you again. That moment was horrific, just terrible. And it went down from there.
Her family stopped talking to her. She had nothing that she needed to live on her own. No money, no job, no place to live. Her head was shaved. She had only her nun's clothing. And then help began to appear.
If you want to know how God took care of me, I cannot believe it, how it really happened. First of all, I had no clothes.
She met an older couple who would take her out for dinner. They loved nuns, and they saw that Eileen was a good person. So she let them in on her hopes of escape.
I called them my angels. That older couple, they owned a woman's dress shop. They had clothes in their car as samples. They gave me 12 outfits.
Then she was interviewed by Newsday about her charity work. And after the interview, Eileen confessed her plan to the journalist and explained that she still had no job and no money.
She goes home and she tells her editor, he was Stan Asimov, the fella I grew up with.
The editor, Stan Asimov, said he knew Eileen.
He said, I'm the little Jewish boy who lived across the street from you, and we grew up together. I could not believe it.
He promised her a job at Newsday.
He said, when you leave, come to the personnel, sign in, the job is waiting.
So early one morning when no one was looking, Eileen stepped out of the convent with $80 in her pocket and boarded a bus to New York City.
And I was in full, you know, nun regalia. And I got on that bus and I went into, I think it was Grand Central Station. And I went to, I think it was a movie house. And I changed. I took off my nun habit, put on clothes. Then I stayed and watched a movie.
Eileen took the job at Newsday. Eventually, she went back to teaching. She rented a sparsely furnished apartment and got married and had a daughter. She still goes to church. And when the collection basket comes around, she thinks about what Sister Anna would do.
I don't always like to give in church, as my husband knows, because I gave my life. But what I do is I'll just give a $20 bill to somebody here or there or wherever. I just think that, you know, faith is a great thing in all religions, and kindness to others. And that's the way I feel in life.
Big thanks to Eileen O'Toole for sharing her story to Snap. You can find out more about Eileen's story and her book, At Sister Anna's Feet, on our website, snapjudgment.org. Of course, that piece was produced by none other than our own Anna Sussman. Now then, it has been far too long since Snap regular contributor Joel Ben-Easy stopped by the place. He wandered into Snap Studios recently, and he recalled for us visiting Japan for the very first time. Joel, he had performed at a Jewish community center in Tokyo when the rabbi asked him to come help clean the Jewish graveyard. Joel, he thought about it for a while, but of course, in the end, he agreed.
So we got to the graveyard in Yokohama and set to work. The grass was overgrown and the gravestones were dirty and some needed dirt carved out of the letters. And It's what you do for the dead because they can't do it themselves. And as we were cleaning, the rabbi came up to me and said, "See that man over there? That's Joseph Shimkin. Go up and talk to him. I think he has a story to tell." And I went up and introduced myself. I said, "Are you Mr. Shimkin?" He said, "Yeah, who are you?" I said, I'm a storyteller. I'm looking for stories." "A storyteller?" He spoke English with a thick Yiddish accent and threw in an occasional Japanese phrase, and even the Japanese phrases had a thick Yiddish accent. "Doma arigato gozaimashite." And he said, "If you're a storyteller, do you tell the story of Senpō Sugihara?" And I said, "No, I don't know who, what is Senpō Sugihara?" He said, "You should tell his story because he saved my life." He had my attention. He said, "You know, I'm not from around here." This much I gathered. And he told me a story that went back to the late 1930s. He'd been from Poland, and he was living in Kaunas, Lithuania. And as the war approached, as Jews were being rounded up, he began to realize he was trapped. And he told me a story of going from embassy to embassy to embassy, looking for visas anywhere. United States, Australia, Great Britain, all said the same thing: "We have enough Jews, no thank you." He said, "So in desperation, I went to knock on the door of the Japanese embassy." He said, "Of course, it was crazy. Japan was entering an alliance with Nazi Germany. There was no way they would provide safe passage." He told me about going in and seeing a kindly man sitting behind a desk. He told him his story. And the man nodded very politely and said, "You want a visa, but my government will not grant it. Not even a transit visa to go through Japan." He said, "But I will ask." And so this man, Chione Senpō Sugihara, wired to headquarters in Japan, and they wired back absolutely no. Mr. Sugihara looked at Mr. Shimkin a long time and finally said, "And what will happen if you don't receive visas?" And Mr. Shimkin said, "If we don't receive visas, we will be taken off in trains and will be killed." He looked at a big box in the corner of the room and said, "Come back tomorrow." The next day, Mr. Shimkin explained, he went in and saw that Senpō Sugihara had spent the entire night writing visas by hand. In those days, visas had to be done by hand, stamped officially, and he had done 300. And then he continued, and he continued with his wife, working day and night. He didn't stop to eat for the next 3 weeks, writing visas by hand, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. Word of this went to the Japanese government. Outraged, they demanded he return. They pulled his credentials. And he told me that the last he had seen of Senpō Sugihara was on a train being taken back to Japan, writing visas and passing them out the window. Mr. Shimkin told me Senpō Sugihara had written 6,000 visas. And so we escaped, and we all came here to Tokyo. Some went on to the United States from Tokyo. Some went on to Great Britain after the war. Some went to Australia. He said, "Of all those Jews who came here to Japan, I'm the last one left." He said, "I like it here. It feels like home. The people are kind." And then he said to me, "Mr. Storyteller, you should tell his story, the story of Senpō Sugihara." When I got back, I did some research on Senpō Sugihara. And exactly how many visas he wrote is hard to say. Estimates range from 1,600 to 6,000. The visas were transit visas, so a single visa might serve an entire family. Because of that, it's hard to know exactly how many Jews he got out of Lithuania. But the Simon Wiesenthal Center estimates that there are 40,000 Jews alive today because of Senpō Sugihara's action. What's clear, though, is what happened to Sugihara and his family. He was transferred to another post, then another, and another, and eventually stripped of diplomatic immunity, so that when the war ended, he and his family spent 21 months of forced labor in a Soviet prison camp. When they finally did return to Japan, he was a shamed man. No more work in diplomatic corps, and he made his living any way he could. For a time, he sold light bulbs door to door. Later, he found work as a translator. But during his lifetime, the Japanese government never forgave him for what he did. He died in shame. It was some years later. I went back to Japan. I told stories again at the Jewish Community Center. And afterwards, the rabbi came up to me and I said, "Hey, how was Joseph Shimkin?" And he smiled and said, "Well, two things happened last week. One was that Joseph Shimkin passed away. We buried him in that very graveyard you helped clean up. The other was, just before that, the Japanese Ministry of Education changed their official position on Senpo Sugihara. They decided his story should be told in textbooks. And now, every Japanese schoolchild will hear the story of Senpo Sugihara."
Joel Ben Izzy. Thank you, Joel, for making sure the world does not forget. Joel Ben Izzy's memoir, The Beggar King and the Secret of Happiness, is available right now from his website, storypage.com. That piece was produced by Stephanie Fu. Now, when Snap Judgment continues, we're going to get locked up. We're going to meet pure evil, and we're going to be thankful anyway. When Snap Judgment, the gratitude episode, continues, stay tuned.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Gratitude Special. Today, we're highlighting some of the stories from the past year that we are especially thankful for. And next up, we're going to Snap Judgment Live, where you get the best seat in the house for an amazing performance with Mr. Jack McCarthy.
Come on, ladies and gentlemen, this is just getting started. We just had the youngest person ever on the Snap stage, and now we're about to go to the original gangster. Mr. Jack McCarthy is a legend in the performance storytelling circles. I cannot wait for you to hear him. I'm going to get out of the way. Mr. Jack McCarthy.
Thank you for that introduction, Glenn. I don't mind being called original, but gangsta might be a bit of a stretch. I was just old enough to be out on the sidewalk by myself, and every day I would come home crying, beaten up by the same little girl. I was Jackie, the firstborn, the apple of every eye. Gratuitous meanness bewildered me, and as soon as she'd hit me, I'd bawl like a baby. I knew that boys were not supposed to cry, but they weren't supposed to hit girls either. And I was shocked when my father said, "Hit her back." I thought it was a great idea. But the only thing I remember about that girl today is the look that came over her face after I did hit her back. She didn't cry. Instead, her eyes got narrow, and I thought, "Jackie, you just made a terrible mistake." And she really beat the crap out of me. It was years before I trusted my father's advice again. I eventually learned to fight enough to protect myself from girls. But the real issue was the crying, and that hasn't gone away. Oh, I don't cry anymore. I don't sob. I don't make noise. I just have hair-triggered tear ducts, and always at all the wrong things. Tom Baudet saying, "We'll leave the light on for you." I always cried at the last scene of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. In movies, I despise the easy manipulation that never even bothers to engage my feelings. It just comes straight from my eyes, but there's not a damn thing I can do about it, and I hate myself for it. The surreptitious nose blow, a discreet 4 minutes after the offending scene. My daughters are onto me, my wife, they all know exactly when to give me that quick sidelong glance. What must they think of me? In real life, I don't cry anymore when things hurt. Never a tear at 17 when my mother died, my father. I never cried for my first marriage. But today, I often cry when things turn out well. An unexpected act of simple human decency. New evidence against all odds of how much someone loves me. I think all this is why I never wanted a son. I always supposed my son would be like me, and that when he'd cry, it would bring back every indelible humiliation of my own life. And in some word or gesture, I'd betray what I was feeling, and he'd mistake and think I was ashamed of him. He'd carry that the rest of his life. I know. Daughters are easy. You can pick them up, you can hug them, you can say, "There, there, it's all right. Everything is going to be all right." And for that moment, you really believe that you can make enough of it right. Enough. The unskilled labor of love. And if you cry a little with them for all the inevitable gratuitous meannesses of life, that crying is not to be ashamed of. But for years, my great fear was the moment I might have to deal with the crying son. But I don't have one. We came close once, between Megan and Kathleen. The doctors told us there was something wrong. And when Joan went into labor, they said the baby would be born dead. But he wasn't. Very briefly, before he died, I heard him cry.
Last year, the world lost a true gentleman. I was honored and grateful to work with Jack McCarthy, a man who kept making magic right to the very end. Thank you, Jack, for everything. Now then, Stamp Judgment Stephanie Fu. She spoke to singer-songwriter Sean Hayes. You may know him for his song, Powerful Stuff.
Powerful, 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 powerful. Powerful, powerful.
But Sean's story does not start with his music. It starts with a book that was given to him as a present.
And inside the book, there was a bunch of different stories. And one of the stories was taken from a radio program called Tossing Away the Keys, which was about men who had been serving death row sentences in Angola prison. A lot of the men are afraid they're going to be forgotten in jail. They had interviewed several of these men, the The one that stuck out was named Maurice Bickham, who had been in Angola prison, I think, for 40-some years, and 14 of those years was on death row in solitary confinement. Here is the tape from Tossing Away the Keys.
My name is Maurice Bickham. My number is 75251, and I'm 72 years old. I've been in prison since 1958. 31 years later, and I'm still locked up. My crime is murder.
In 1958, he had been in a fight with his girlfriend, and the police showed up, and he got into an argument with them, and supposedly they were Dragon Clan's members. They said they were going to come back and get him later that night to kill him, and he went home, and then later that night, they did show up. They shot at him, and he got shot, and he shot both of those police officers. He was a black man living in a white neighborhood, and of course nobody came forward to witness what they had saw in his neighborhood. So he was put on trial and sentenced to death and spent 14 years in solitary confinement before the death penalty was abolished in Louisiana. So then he served out life without parole. One of the things that he talked about in the story was tending these rose bushes and how they gave him hope and extra meaning serving his sentence.
Come over here, I want to introduce you to the beautiful rose bush on the whole yard. This is one here, is my favorite. I named it after my wife, Ernestine. It's a beautiful pink rose, and somewhere or another I keep it trimmed and uniform up until I call it my beauty. I know it sounds funny, but these are my company keepers. I enjoy these bushes. See, if it wasn't for these bushes, I wouldn't have nothing to do. So these bushes have come to be close, very close to me.
What really stuck out to me was this man who had such dignity in his voice and his outlook, even though he had spent all these years in prison and really had no hope of getting out. He still did have hope, and he didn't have any blame in his voice for his situation. And so it stuck with me, and I wrote a song called Rosebush Inside, and in the song I just wanted to remind myself to be grateful for what I have. Just kind of an everyday little mantra to sing to yourself sometimes when you're waiting in traffic and getting angry about silly things.
He was wrongly accused, 40 years and still survived. Don't you know, not for a moment, no. You think the world owes you, she don't owe you a thing.
I wanted people to know about his story, and that's why beside the title I put Maurice Bickham, but then one of the letters in his name on the record had got misspelled. So then I reblogged about it after I put the record out, just to let people know and point people towards his story. I never did write him. I thought about it, but, you know, in the back of my head I was thinking he probably already had passed away. And then it wasn't until years after that that I got a little strange email. And I opened it and said, "Dear Mr. Hayes, I was listening to your song, Rosebush, which was from me when I was in Angola, and it's my great desire to visit your performance at the rickshaw stop in January 2009.
If it was possible, it would be a pleasure for you to make it available for me and my family and friends to come and see you perform and meet you in person. Thank you and God bless you. My name is Maurice Bickham. God bless America. Home sweet home, I'm glad to be in it."
Maurice had survived 37 years in prison and always retained this faith that he would get out.
I had strong hopes of getting out. I locked up on a Saturday morning. Monday night I said, "Lord, I'm in trouble. I want to know when I'm going to get out of it." Honey, I don't know who I was in, a dream or vision or what, but my grandmother come back to foot of my bed and talk with me just like I'm talking with you.
A vision of family members that had passed came and said he would make it through this.
So Mama said, "Go do help others all you can." I said, "I'm going to start right now." And that's what I did. Doing everything I could to help others, and I kept my record straight.
I think that his straight record is actually what saved him. The producer who made the radio piece, David Isay, started a campaign to free Maurice. So a judge commuted his sentence to 37.5 years on good behavior, miraculously.
My lawyer says to me, Bickham, you stay in 37 years. What you gonna be when you get out? It's just a plain old Bickham up and down the street. I got out on January 10, 1996. I never will forget that day. That was the happiest day of my life. Oh, it was one Wednesday morning. It was kind of amazing. And the warden, when we walked to the front gate, he said to me, Bickham, what you thinking about? I'm thinking about them 7 times y'all give me a death sentence at 12:01. I said, now tonight at 12:01, I'm signing myself out. He shook my hand and said, have good luck. I said, that's all I can have. And I walked out, kneeled ground, picked up some of that dirt, kissed it, put it back there. And here I am today. My being locked up was a wonderful experience and a blessing to me. And people said, what? How could it be a blessing? Well, I like fast cars. And if I'd have been out, I'd have wrapped one around a telegram post or a bridge or something, been dead. You know, God checked me, put me in a place and took care of me. Out now. And anybody drive a little over speed limit, I don't want to ride with them. Being free is being able to make your own decisions. You have to bear your own burden that comes out of your own decision.
Now Maurice is 95, and his dignity and his joy for life to find me and to come out and go to a rock and roll show late at night and show up. He's just living so much more fully than so many people who are 20 even, with no anger, even though he's been through something none of us could imagine. He showed up to the show in a limousine with his friend, and they were both dressed full on to the nines, came in, got to meet him and talk to him for a while. He was mystified at where I heard the story, and he wondered if I'd maybe spent time in prison with him. I played the song, you know, right away. I wanted to introduce it. It was such a strange story to try to tell an audience full of people. People are understanding this in a much bigger way.
There's a man doing time, keeping the rose bush alive. He was wrongly accused, 40 years and still survived.
There's a man. Oh boy, it was beautiful. Everybody was dancing. Well, he had some songs that I really loved. But the one by the rose bush, it kind of brought back memories, you know? It made me feel that the thing that I longed for had come to be reality. Like when I'd be sitting on that bush, hoping that I'd be out someday. Now I'm out and feel good to know that somebody still remembers me.
And now the responsibility and the understanding of how stories work is more being revealed to me. You can't help but change the story by telling a story. You actually become part of a story. So it's a strange responsibility to be aware of.
Don't you know you got a wall of sunshine for a moment, oh. You got a wall of sunshine to think the world owes you. Got a wall of sunshine, it don't owe you a thing. Got a wall of sunshine.
Thank you so much to David Isay, the founder of StoryCorps. He produced Tossing Away the Keys, and we thank him for letting us use his tape on our show. Thanks as well to Sean Hayes. He made all the music in this piece. And finally, thank you. Thank you, Maurice Bickham, for sharing your story with Snap.
Snap judgment. That it's good. It's good sometimes to think a matter over before you make decision. I don't make no swift decision no more. I say like this: if it's too important to rest overnight on, well, I don't know how much to do with it, you know.
All right, Maurice. We will definitely take that into consideration. You're listening to Snap Judgment, the Gratitude Special. And when we return, Snap Judgment's Anna Sussman searches for something she will never find. It's an amazing story. Right after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Gratitude Special from PRX and NPR. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're reaching back to highlight some of the stories that we are especially thankful for. And a person that I'm especially thankful for is Anna Sussman, because she's one of the good ones. She has this thing about justice. And Anna recently went to a former war zone to see if there really was such a thing. Snap Judgment.
Morning a few years ago when I woke up knowing I was about to meet a man that good people had told me was evil. I was covering the peace process in northern Uganda. I started my reporting at a camp for displaced families. Dark, sooty rain clouds rolled over the clumps of makeshift thatched huts that had become home to hundreds of thousands during the war. The sky opened up and dropped heavy torrents of rain down onto the camp. I ducked into a damp mud hut. Rain began to seep through the thatched roof. I talked to Janet. Her brothers and sisters were killed by the rebel group, the Lord's Resistance Army. Her mother is buried in a mound of dirt and hay outside her hut.
My father dead. My mom dead also. I come up.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
No. They killed them.
Yeah, mom. I talked to Yafis. He was captured by the rebels as a boy and forced to cut another child to pieces when he tried to escape. Janet and Yafis wanted the war to end. They were willing to forgive the warlords and let them live free, if that's what it took to bring peace. But the International Criminal Court, they wanted the men responsible for the massacres, for enslaving child brides, for cutting off the lips of civilians, the men in oversized sunglasses and army fatigues, they wanted them to face judgment for their crimes.
Recent warrants by the International Criminal Court have turned the spotlight on a rebel group in Uganda.
But the warlords weren't having any of it. They said as long as the arrest warrants remained, they would continue to fight. The attacks would go on. So the people of northern Uganda, the victims of the decades-long war, said forget the warrants, forget the international halls of justice, we want peace. We'll forgive the warlords. Give them amnesty, let them go free, if that's what it takes. Who gets to decide what happens to these men? The victims of the war, desperate for peace by any means? Or the International Criminal Court, whose offices are out of reach of the wrathful warlords? I caught a ride out of the camp, and next came the hard part. An interview I had secured with the Lord's Resistance Army No. 3 Commander, Kenneth Banya. Kidnapped children used to call him the Nasty One. He said to have ordered attacks, enslaved wives, and masterminded the whole war. He said to have orchestrated very, very bad things. Things human beings should not do to one another. I prepare for a hostile meeting, peppered with pointed questions about his role in the war. I was ready. I wasn't going to hold anything back. I debated whether or not to shake his hand. I sat down nervously in the courtyard of the restaurant where I'd arranged to meet him. I flipped through my notebook. Kenneth Banya strode through the door with a wide smile, his hand outstretched, salt and pepper hair, toes sticking out of plastic flip-flops.
Anna, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
How was the day?
It was okay.
Good.
Yeah, it was okay. No sunglasses, no gun, no fatigues. No menace. He asked me if I'd like some tea. I watch him stir spoonfuls of sugar and powdered cream into a tiny teacup. His eyes are squinty and kind. He talks about his life, He grew up on a farm in a small village.
I had 5 brothers and 1 sister.
I'm caught off guard by his grandfatherly nature. He invites me to his home down the road, the one the government gave him, along with the amnesty and his monthly salary. A 2-story concrete apartment with a blue light bulb swinging from the ceiling and paper posters of nature scenes tacked to the walls. He's kind and relaxed. He explains that he was nervous to come out of the bush, nervous that people would be angry at him, but they were forgiving.
It was not easy to mix with people. I was afraid, but it was the people themselves who encouraged me to move free.
And finally, I approach the subject of the mass atrocities he's said to have orchestrated. So, did you order attacks on civilians?
Did you take forced wives?
Did you plan the abduction of 139 girls from the Aboke Girls' School?
Did you order troops to cut off the lips of villagers?
He just smiles and denies it all. But he made it clear. The war would not end until the remaining leaders were granted amnesty. Then he introduced me to his nieces and turned on the radio. Maybe it's these guys, the guys who have committed the most gruesome of human acts, who can look you in the eye and convince you that they're guilty of nothing. Banya is accused of spending years plotting attacks on innocent civilians, and someone on Earth needed to judge him, not on his smile or the way he took his tea, but on the evidence, the facts, the testimonies of people like Janet. But Janet didn't care if Banya was judged. She said she was happy to let him live in his apartment and enjoy his amnesty, as long as he stayed away from her. I thanked him for his time. It began to rain. I shook his hand and walked away down the dirt road. And soon heavy, swollen puddles turned the road into mud and soaked my clothes. I looked back to see Kenneth Banya ducking into his concrete apartment out of the rain.
Thank you so much, Anna Sussman. Oh, I'm grateful for a lot of things, Snappers, but I'm especially thankful that you chose to spend an hour with the Snap crew. Know this, there are hours, hours of Snap available right now. In fact, you could go to the Jackson Hole, Wyoming airport, fly around the entire world before arriving back at the Jackson Hole airport, and there are enough Snap episodes available for you to enjoy a new Snap the entire trip without having to repeat a single one. What? Subscribe to the podcast, snapjudgment.org. Facebook, Snap Judgment. Twitter, Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by the most unlikely group of pilgrims ever to set foot in the new world. Please, somebody fix a plate for the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Mussini Miller breaks beats. The next door neighbor, peeking through the blinds, Anna Sussman. Joe Rosenberg rocked the cranberry sauce. Nancy Lopez made the sweet potatoes. Davey Kim hooked up the turkey. Julie DeWitt can't cook. Mac and cheese provided by Anna Adlerstein, Liza Smith, Leon Morimoto, and Aurora Soria. Apple pie with cheddar cheese, which I know about that. Delivered by Jasmine Aguilera. Now, are you planning on getting your holiday meal from the frozen food section? Not this year, Snappers. Just stop by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They'll hook you up with a meal you will not believe. Tell them Snap sent you. What? Oh, there. Yeah. Tell them This American Life sent you. Ira and them. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, doesn't believe in gravy, and it's a shame. Let the record reflect that Snap, on the other hand, takes a firm pro-gravy stance. American, PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago knows the holidays are about food and drink. You know what I'm saying? Ain't that right? WBEZ. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you can screw the nonsense, man. I'm going to have a peanut butter sandwich with Welch's grape jelly and a cold glass of milk for the holidays. Yeah! Just that. With the crust cut off, Trix, that's all I want. Leave me alone. And you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.